Welcome back to the program. The world is clearly moving towards cities. It's estimated that in the next decade, as much as 70% of the world's population will be living in urban environments. How we make those cities safe may very well determine the quality of life for future generations. There's no better example of keeping crime down than what happened in New York, where crime dropped 80%. Over 19 years. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Franklin Zimring. He's the William G. Simon Professor of Law at UC Berkeley's Bolt Hall Law School. It is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his newest book, The City That Became Safe, New York's Lessons for Urban Crime and Its Control. Franklin Zimring, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Begin by talking about the scope and magnitude of this decline in crime in New York.
Well, now, there's no product placement here, but what I like to say is this is Guinness Book of World Records. and what I mean by that is that, now remember, in the 1990s, there was a crime decline all over the United States, something of a mystery, but on the order of about 40%, and everybody had it, and we had it out here. What happened in New York City, however, from their high point in 1990, is if you use a rule of thumb, they had a crime decline that was twice as long as the country's, and it was also twice as big. And that cut through thresholds that we'd never seen before in a large American city. Homicide from its 1990 high was down 82%. Robbery was down 84%. Burglary was down 85%. Auto theft in 2009 was 6% of what the auto theft rate was in 1990. Now, the first thing that is extraordinary about those numbers is it had never happened before. But the second thing that's extraordinary about those numbers is what wasn't going on in most of New York City over the same period of time. The population didn't change much. Outside Manhattan, which is only 20% of the city's population, the population changes were in exactly the opposite direction of a declining crime rate. And the number of people locked up, which was continued to go up through the 90s and after everywhere else in the country, it didn't go up during that period. So you had essentially the same city with the same structural and educational and economic problems, the same people, and no more criminals locked up, and crime didn't disappear, but it went hugely down. And let me give two statistics on homicide to illustrate the dramatic nature of the decline. Mm-hmm. The homicide rate per year was 30.7 per 100,000 in 1990. In 2009, it was 5.6 per 100,000. That's instead of talking about an 82% drop, the important thing is to say, well, how much was left? And the answer was a pretty small fraction. Or to put it a different way, the homicide rate in 2009 was lower than it was in 1961 in New York City. And the thing that's amazing about that is that the 60s is where crime went up everywhere, and New York had sort of rolled things back, and that was absolutely incredible. We hadn't seen it before, and so you would expect at this point that you could be talking to the authors of 15 books about how it happened and what it means and what mm-hmm. it teaches the rest of us. But the other funny thing that happens, at least in New York City, is that when you have a lot less crime, you also have an awful lot less talk about crime. It turns out that it's an awful lot like dentistry. People only talk about dentists when their teeth hurt. And when their teeth stop hurting, they're talking about other things. So if you go to New York talk radio, you'll talk about Yankee pitching or the stock market or Washington politics. But in a funny sense, as a sign of how dramatic the crime decline has been, people have stopped examining it for what it means.
One of the things that's so remarkable about it is that it fell below the level of what we might consider an analogy to be kind of background noise. It fell below the level of what we thought was the basic crime rate or a basic construction of crime rate within any kind of urban environment like that.
That's absolutely right. And what it does is contradict the way in which we had thought crime was driven. If you wonder why it is that Americans have spent the last generation and a half filling prisons as nobody's ever filled them before, it isn't that prisons were our favorite solution for combating crime. They were the only way that public policymakers thought we could, because we engaged in what I like to call supply-side criminology. And that is, our theory was that once you have high-rate offenders out there, there were really only two things you could do with them. One of them is lock them up. And during the period of time that you do that, they're not out offending on the streets. And the other is, if you leave them anywhere else, they're going to continue to offend. Well, under those circumstances, there are all sorts of consequences. One of them is that there's nothing other than locking people up that you can do to prevent crime. Why won't the police work? Because the police can't be everywhere, and the criminals can just wait them out. So you send three cops to 125th Street on a Tuesday, and so a robbery doesn't happen on 125th Street. But that theory was, yeah, but the robbers will just go to 140th Street, or they'll wait until Wednesday. Well, what you find out when you see that New York's police do, in fact, make a permanent dent in crime, is that criminals are an awful lot less persistent and more distractible than we thought. The slogan here, the social science lingo, is that the things that drive crime numbers are a lot more situational and contingent than we thought. So that if you can prevent a robbery on Tuesday night at 125th Street, what that really means is one less robbery in New York. That all of a sudden, this prison strategy that you thought was the only way to prevent crime is at the first instance only one of many ways that you can drive crime numbers down. And then we get to the second huge surprise from New York. It turns out that if high-rate offenders are really that distractible, that it's also difficult to predict how much crime they'd be committing 4 or 5 years from now. And when you read the numbers very carefully, the effectiveness of prison in contributing to crime rates is much less than we thought it was. The example from New York that just stunned me was that we found out that when crime was very high in New York City, the odds of somebody released from prison back to New York City being reconvicted of another felony within 3 years was better than 1 in 4. It was 28%. And using that just as a measure of how much crime those folks were committing, they were committing a lot of crime. But as the general crime rate went down, the first 3 years that convicted high-rate offenders who were released back to New York City streets, their personal crime rate also went down. And it went down big time. By 2006, the three-year reconviction rate, instead of 28%, was 10%. Or their personal crime rates had dropped 64%. Now, that's great news if what you're doing is street policing or probation supervision, or if you're a parole officer, or even if you're those reverends who were out there doing midnight basketball games and getting mocked by the right wing in the United States. How can that prevent the crime rate? But it's very bad news if what you're doing is investing in long-term imprisonment. Because if they're committing less than one-third of the crime they used to be committing, that means that their long-range dangerousness is much lower than you thought it was and much less predictable. So the cost-effectiveness of the prison cell has gone down dramatically at the same time that the cost-effectiveness of everything else that's plausible, what you can do to alter environments, has gone up.
And talking about the altered environments, urban legend at least has it that one of the factors was this whole notion of quality of life policing, getting the graffiti removed, getting the squeegee guys off the street. How true was that?
Well, it's a mixture of the fact that the police got very aggressive and very tough, even on minor offenses. But what it misread was what the cops were doing, where they were doing it, and why they were doing it. Some kinds of minor offenses, the arrest rate went tremendously up. Marijuana arrests went up tenfold. Is that because the cops were concerned about marijuana and the quality of life? Of course not. What they were doing was they were stopping people who they thought were robbers and burglars on the streets and arresting them for minor crimes just to get their fingerprints to find out if they were outstanding warrants. Now, how do we know that? We know that for three reasons. Number one, they weren't arresting everybody who was likely to have marijuana. They were arresting young men of color in tough neighborhoods. Number two, they were only doing it in neighborhoods with high rates of violent crime. And the so-called broken windows policing strategy, what the people who invented that said, is that you want to do it in marginal neighborhoods when you can send signals and still save things. You don't want to go to the places where the crime rate is the worst, Wilson and Kelling said, because they're probably hopeless. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what the New York City cops did. They threw the cops where the crime rates were the highest, the so-called hot spots. And that is intensely true. And it has to be, because if you're going to drive down the homicide rate by 82%, you're not going to do it by visiting the marginal neighborhoods. You're going to go where the crime is. The third reason we know that it wasn't about quality of life for broken windows is that there are some crimes where it's obvious and public that the law is being violated, but the people who are violating the law don't look like robbers and burglars to the cops. Prostitution is a classic broken windows arrest because the street prostitute has to announce she's violating the law or her customers won't know she's there. But she's the wrong gender and a little bit too made up to be a burglar or a robber. So she's the perfect test of whether it's quality of life enforcement or street crime. And the high point, if you will, of prostitution arrests in New York City was 1991. They never went up. And prostitution arrests now are less than half the arrests that there were. But public gambling arrests are lower in New York in 2009 than they were in 1991. And the reason for that is that the people who are doing the public gambling are too old to be burglars and robbers, And the people who are out hooking on the streets are the wrong gender, and they're in the wrong business.
Of course, involved in that is a degree of racial profiling, which nobody likes to talk about.
Oh, there is no question that what went on in how New York did its hotspots policing was exactly the opposite of community policing. They were aggressive, they were impolite, and the concentrated targets of all this are young men of color in poor neighborhoods. And that concentration of whatever the cops are going to do, it probably goes with the territory of going to the highest crime neighborhoods. The real question is this. Does the computer mapping strategy, does the concentration on hotspots, does the destruction of public drug markets, and we ought to talk a little bit about those, that was another thing of great importance, that was done in a very profiling way in New York, does it have to be that impolite to be that effective? The New York cops believe it does, but the truth is that what we don't know is whether the way in which they did it, the toughness of policing, added value to the strategies they were using. It might have, or it might not. And because it's so costly, one of the next things we have to do with this notion that cops can make a difference is find out whether that difference has to leave the kind of very destructive footprints that it did leave in New York in order to work. And unfortunately, that is a genuinely open question now.
What was so dramatic in New York were two things. One, the tremendous number of police that were added to the New York police force over this period of time. And two, the dramatic changes in the department from a department that was pretty laissez-faire and pretty laid back to one that was, as you talk about, hyper-aggressive.
Yeah, laissez-faire is the polite way of saying it. Lazy. The first two syllables of that French. And of course, one of the great ironies is this. The larger the marginal difference in policing, the bigger the change that you can notice. So in a way, the weakness of police in the previous period is one of the reasons you can see the effects so dramatically. On the more police, in the 1990s, New York City added cops like nobody had ever done it before. And it wasn't, by the way, Mayor Giuliani's who had this idea. It was Mayor Dinkins, and it wasn't Commissioner Bratton that added most of the cops. It was Commissioner Brown. But whomever it was, the number of uniformed officers went up by a little bit over 40% in the 1990s. And so it looks like more cops, at least if they're used effectively, contributed substantially to the success. But then you get the period after the turn of the century, and things get a little bit more complicated. Because rather than continuing to add police after 2000, the department actually reduced the police force by more than 4,000 officers over the next 10 years. Now, that should have been a perfect experiment of whether you need the extra cops to have the effectiveness. And if it was that, then it has a very ambiguous result, because New York City's comparative advantage over the other big cities in the United States is just as great in the period after the turn of the century, a 21% advantage to New York City, as it was during the decade when it was adding all the cops. Okay, so does that mean that the additional manpower didn't contribute value. No, it doesn't. And what it does do is make the job much more complicated, because while the number of police per 100,000 citizens kept going down after 2000, the number of cops per 100 serious crimes, which is another way of measuring how many cops you had, actually went up during that second period. And the reason it went up is that crime was dropping even faster than the number of cops. So what the book concludes is that while the New York experience doesn't prove the extra value of manpower, that is a probable contribution to what was done. Good strategies help, but good strategies plus more cops are definitely a help.
And this was one of the points that Bratton made, actually, when he moved to Los Angeles, when he argued strenuously that the biggest problem in L.A. and when he got there was that there weren't enough cops.
Yeah, and Los Angeles now becomes, Los Angeles is a very dramatically different city than New York, and it is the next place to closely examine the effectiveness of police strategy. When I say it's dramatically different than New York, the population density in New York City is four times what it is in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is a place where most cops are in cars, not on foot. The density in New York means foot patrol. So if you were looking for contrasts among mega cities, those would be at different extremes. And Bratton got to Los Angeles in 2002, and sure enough, just like you were describing in New York, the reputation of the Los Angeles Police Department in the before Bratton era was one of simultaneously being abusive and ineffective. And the crime numbers that have been coming out of Los Angeles ever since suggest that this may be a second demonstration, not only of police effectiveness, but now of police environments which are very different from New York City and where we couldn't be sure of the effectiveness. And if I'm sitting there in Oakland, for instance, in many ways what's going on in Los Angeles is of more direct importance to Oakland than what went on in New York, because the geographic spreads and the need to use automobiles in policing that characterize Los Angeles are also the playing field for Oakland crime. So the Los Angeles story may be an important confirmation of all the materials that we've been seeing from New York City, and may be a very direct applicability to other California cities.
Talk about the other things that you mentioned, the drug situation before, the other things that the police were doing that created this added value.
Well, the drug story is one that, again, revisits a massive, massive debate that we had in the United States during the period from 85 to 95. The big debate during our war on drugs peak years was between a hard line that our first national drug czar, William Bennett, sold rather convincingly in the late 1980s. And that was that the only way to reduce drug violence, to reduce AIDS and all of the other problems that were panicking the country about drug use and drug abuse in the late 80s, was to substantially reduce the amount of cocaine and heroin that was sold and ingested. On the other side were a bunch of liberals from the public health community who were selling a notion called harm prevention, saying, look, you don't go after all drugs at all times. What you do is you create priorities. You find out what your serious problems are, and you try and target strategies to approach those. What's fascinating about what those tough profiling New York cops did in drug markets was that they became great students of harm prevention. The cops increased their police manpower by 137% during the 1990s, but they used that manpower not for an all-out war on drugs, but to destroy the open-air drug markets that had become the catastrophic centers in New York. And once they managed to close the public drug markets, and they did that very well, drug violence down over the 19-year period that we studied by more than 90%. And the streets in those places that used to be open-air drug markets were relatively quite free of serious violence and of the interruption of people going about their daily lives. But what was the effect on the amount of drugs that were taken and sold? The answer is that by every measure we have, and we have a lot of different measures, drug use was relatively stable. But the cops reduced their manpower back to its 1990 levels because they'd solved the problem of public impact and they'd solved the problem of drug violence. They essentially had won their war on drug violence without winning their war on drugs. And what happened is that you never know who your friends are. The public health community got its most convincing evidence that its harm reduction approach worked spectacularly well from people who the public health community would have thought were allergic to partway solutions, who sounded more like the drug warriors. But the police department in New York City, I think, is quite happy with what our old drug czar would consider only a halfway success.
Where does this stand in New York today? And to what extent is this something that requires a kind of eternal vigilance as opposed to something that is quote-unquote solved?
Well, those are fascinating questions that I really can't answer. The first thing I can tell you is where the citizens of New York are on the question, and that is they're bored. They're not thinking about crime or talking about crime again. This is a bad week to say this because a New York police officer was killed during a robbery. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that New York has become Tokyo or Hong Kong. The miracle in New York is that more than 80% of safety crime can be reduced without changing the culture or the population. But even at the end of that dramatic decrease, you do not have the safest city in the world. What you have is a city that, by American standards of lethal violence, is extraordinarily safe. The homicide rate is still a third of New York's in Toronto or Montreal, and a tenth of New York in Tokyo or Hong Kong. So there's still crime and violence, and there's still some concern with it. But the real question is, since an awful lot of what happened all over the country were cyclical declines in crime that we can't really explain. The New York City police differences are responsible for 32% of the robbery decline and 32% of the burglary decline and 21% of the auto theft decline. But now, wait a minute, those numbers are a lot less dramatic than the 82 and 84 and 94%. And some of the rest of that was cyclical change. And the problem with cyclical change, as those of you who've been studying the stock market might know, is that the same things that go down on you, if down is good news, can come up on you too. And the same things that give you higher stock prices can start producing lower stock prices. We don't know how much of the cyclical and unexplained benefits turn out to be reversible. What we do know is that the efforts we then make to respond to the new problems will be concentrated on the city's environments instead of the state's prison system. That if New York City's got to invest a dollar now in 2011 or 2012 in crime prevention, they want to invest that dollar as close to the corner where the robberies and burglaries are taking place as they can. That we have had a kind of a change in focus in New York City from making policy toward criminals, and we still send people to jail, but instead thinking about where crime happens and having immediate impact on it, rather than thinking that our problem is finding the fellows who are doing it and removing them from the city, we're now trying to make the city a different place where people have to make decisions about whether or not to commit crimes. And that's what we used to think couldn't work in the United States, and now we know it does. We're just not sure why it works, or for how long, or what happens next. I can tell you that if I had to bet on New York City's homicide and robbery rates 5 years from now, I would bet that they'd be very close to where they are now, that most of the progress would stay, but that I think you can't probably squeeze more juice out of those situational and contingent environments than the cops have already done. But I better warn you that all I am doing now is expressing hunches. The best way to know what's going to happen in New York City 5 years from now is to wait 5 years.
Franklin Zimmering, his book is The City That Became Safe, New York's Lessons for Urban Crime and Its Control. Franklin, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure, sir.
Thank you.